Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Today on the Optusport Football Podcast, I'm joined by journalist and presenter Phil Kitramilidis, as well as Michael Bridges. This week, we'll be talking international football as the Socceroos narrowly lose to England at Wembley. And could we see a Euros without Erling Haaland? I'm Mark Schwarzer, and welcome to the Optusport Football Podcast. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Optusport Football Podcast for season 2023-24. With me today, as always, is Phil Kitramilidis, direct from Madrid. Hi, Phil. How's it going?
Buenos dias, amigos. Going very well. How are you?
Not bad, mate. Enjoying life still in the southern part of Spain, as we talked about last week. I'm still loving it down here. This goes without saying. As well as former Leeds United striker, Michael Bridges. Bridgie, everyone's still talking about the David Beckham doco. Firstly, have you seen it?
I certainly have seen it, Schwarzer. Good to see you, pal. I watch it with my wife, and she's not a football fan, but she's a massive fan of David Beckham. So we sat down and watched all the episodes. We binged on it, and I thought it was absolutely magnificent, mate.
Have you played against him or played with? You wouldn't have played with him, right?
Definitely not played with him, Schwarzer. But I'll tell you what I have done. I was looking back in the history books of the games that I've played against David Beckham, right? And there's only two games stand out because I never, ever got a chance to beat Manchester United when I played for Leeds United. But I went back and I had a look. There was a 2-1 victory for Sunderland, right? Back in 1997. We beat them in the league. And Beckham was playing. I came off after 74 minutes, but we were already winning the game 2-1. So that's my highlight over David Beckham and Manchester United. But one that you will absolutely love. My first ever game for Leeds United in 99. We went to Old Trafford and we were playing. We got beat 2-0. But guess how long I lasted in that match, mate?
For you, I reckon 5 minutes.
Oh, just double, mate. 10 minutes, I came off injured. So there's no surprise there. So I've got to win over Manchester United in the locker. I know.
Phil thought I was a bit harsh there by saying coming off after 5 minutes. But no. You've got to know Bridgie's history, Phil. Phil, have you watched it yet?
I have watched it, much in a similar vein to Bridgie. Was sitting down with my wife, who's a big Beckham fan. I just kept hearing the words qué guapo," which means, you know, he's so gorgeous. Basically, hard to disagree. But yeah, it's a very intriguing documentary. Actually, I mean, I was. I'm a little bit younger than you guys, just a tiny bit younger than you guys. So when it was all kicking off with the World Cup and the paparazzi and everything, obviously I was just a teenager. So I remember it, but I don't remember being aware of the sort of press harassment and hounding of these guys. So it was interesting to see that aspect of it in the documentary, which I didn't necessarily remember. Talking of remembering, Mark, do you remember what you were doing on January the 29th, 2000?
Well, it's probably a game against Man United, and I probably let a goal in against David Beckham near post. I think it was. I actually threw it in. We were drawing 0-0. If this is the game, I don't even know, but I'm actually just guessing here. But the game I'm thinking about, I've played against Man United many times and against David Beckham, fortunately. And yeah. we did really, really well. And I played really well up until that moment where I threw one in the back of the net and we lost the game 1-0. Is that the one we're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, you didn't actually lose the game. You drew it 1-1.
Okay, there you go.
You were winning until you made a very uncharacteristic error, because it's true. We watched the highlights and you made some fantastic saves, and then there was not a brilliant piece
there
of
was two things
goalkeeping
that,
in the near post.
Two yeah. things that stood out in that game for me. That was Schwarzy, obviously, at his near post, making an absolute clanger, which everybody loves to see. And it was obviously seeing at the other end of the field and go for Manchester United was another Australian playing, and that was Mark Bosnich. So fair play.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, I think we lost that game 1-0. I'm pretty sure it was 0-0 and we lost 1-0. Anyway, you guys...
Bosnich saved a penalty in that game.
That's right. Absolutely.
From
he
Janino.
Did. Yes. Yeah, he did. Yeah. Well, actually, for me, like I mentioned that game against Beckham, but I said I've played many, many games against him. I don't think One thing I'm going to say, claim to fame, I don't think from what I can remember, unless you guys are going to prove me wrong again, because you've done all this research, of course, to stitch me up, I don't think he scored a free kick against me.
No.
Oh, we couldn't find a free kick. You're absolutely right, by the way. You lost that game 1-0. So, my mistake. I was giving you an extra point. Where
I know. I just remember we were holding on and doing so well at Old Trafford. And I remember just being equally devastating, even more devastating because we actually lost the game, even though I played well up until that point. Yeah, anyway.
It's nearly 24 years later and it's still pretty fresh in your mind.
Yeah, it is. Those games you don't forget. That's for sure.
Yeah, right. Sending you that clip every week.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Reggie. Yeah. I'll send you a clip of you sitting on the bench every week. Way! Or in the stands.
Here we go.
Anyway, let's move on. Australia against England. What a game, right? So Australia, massive opportunity to go to Wembley, playing a packed out Wembley stadium against, what, fourth best team in the world? They've done that a few times now. They've played against top teams and lost them or drawn against Mexico, lost against Argentina, but haven't disgraced themselves, have they, Phil?
They haven't disgraced themselves. I mean, you said they're playing against the fourth best team in the world. It was maybe the fourth best team in England because it was not a first choice England team at all by any stretch of the imagination. You said, what a game again in terms of the actual spectacle from I'm talking about this from an English perspective. It was a little bit flat, a little bit scrappy. England got the win and Australia really competed. I think there were very competitive opponents, good warm up for England, good way for Gareth Southgate to see some of his squad players competing against a side that were really up for it. They were physical. They had some chances as well. So I think for England, it was a decent workout, but not a huge amount more. But for Australia, I think it was a chance to show that, you know, we can compete against the fourth best ranked team in the world. We are progressing, we are improving, and I think this will help spread the game. You know, people seeing Australia competing like this, it was a decent showing. But from an English perspective, it was a bit of a damp squib. Sorry to bring the tone down right at the start of the podcast, but I don't think it was a game that will live long in the memory of many English fans or indeed players.
No, it certainly won't be, Phil. But there was 10 changes made. I think there was only Dunk that had kept his place in that England team from the last game against Scotland when they had a win. But you're still talking about a Grealish, Maddison, Bowen. Ollie Watkins, Gallagher, Henderson obviously gone away, the only one that got booed. Trent Alexander-Arnold. This is an unbelievable starting 11. Now, I'm gonna big up the Socceroos on this because the build-up to this game, I saw that Ange had got back together with Arnie. He'd give a chat and a talk to the squad, a little bit of a pep talk there. I think Gus Hiddink was there as well, if I remember. And you could just feel that they're taking this very, very seriously. And England players that have got the opportunity are not going to go in there with a second-class attitude because they want to prove a point that they want to be in Gareth Southgate's, you know, thinking process. So I'm thinking the first few minutes of this game, how are Australia going to come out and do this? And the high press was there. The intensity was there. I thought that the quality to try and play out as well. And they went toe for toe with some of the best players in the world. Now, to get a result, I mean, it was 1-0. It was a scrappy Ollie Watkins goal that got it through. But I have to say that Australia can hold their heads very high. And it's the first time I've seen the press over here give kudos to an opposition team when they were playing England. I know we've had bloody Taylor's turnips in the past in the years when England have had a real bad defeat and things like that. But they were very, very complimentary. And Gareth Southgate was also complimentary of the way that Australia and Graham Arnold and them came over, handled themselves and went toe for toe. Didn't sit back and try and absorb pressure. Had a real good go of it and basically showcased themselves and put a lot of them players put themselves from the Socceroos on display for clubs in Europe.
You know, I actually think what's interesting, I think Sam Johnson was one of England's best players. He made some really, really good saves, big saves, to keep the score at 0-0 at that particular moment in time as well. So I think that says a lot about the way Australia played. Question I want to ask you, Bridgie, who impressed you the most from Australia on the night?
On the night from Australia, he always stands out for me, mate, Harry Suter. I thought he was absolutely colossal. Every set play, you could see England players looking at him when he's coming up for a corner and they're going, are you kidding me? And then everything that went into Ollie Watkins, whether it was on the floor. I mean, his aerial presence, you understand, because of the, you know, like the the stature of him. But he read the game so well. I thought he when he was getting run in the channels, he timed his tackles perfectly. I enjoyed Craig Goodwin. I thought whenever I saw Craig on the ball in the left wing, his deliveries were very good. He was up for the battle. And he's coming up against one of the best right-backs in the world offensively. All right, defensively maybe. Trent isn't renowned. But Craig had a great game. And Kieran Backus in midfield. I thought that he didn't have a great game, but what he did, he was like a little Jack Russell or a terrier, and he just kept niggling and niggling away at the England midfielders and Gallagher and Henderson. So it was for me, they were the ones that stood out for me in that game.
Surely it's got to be a big concern. I mean, Harry Suter not getting minutes for Leicester. The thing is, I think he did it at the World Cup, right? He came back, he played, I think, a game and a half before the World Cup, maybe the first game against France. I thought Australia, other the first half an hour, were excellent. But after that, they were caught out a little bit. Other than that, he just got better and better. We saw now very little game time, came in and played really well against England. That's got to be a big concern, though. The longer it goes on, Bridgie, without him playing football minutes for his club.
Yeah, without a shadow of a doubt. And I'm sure that Graham Arnold would have had a chat with him about that and said, I mean, Leicester are flying the Championship, and like you say, he's not getting an opportunity. But if you're coming ready, getting ready and prepared for an Asian Cup, the amount of time that Harry had out before the World Cup, listen, I've been in an injury situation. You want to play as many minutes as you can, so you'd be very frustrated. So what he's basically done there, he's put himself in the shop window for an opportunity if he's not getting game time to either say to the manager, I'm ready and waiting here. Which, you know, to have somebody like Harry Suter as backup and not getting a game when you're top of the Championship or involved with the mix, that's pleasing. But I think Harry's got to play if he wants to like have that impact. He's got to play on a regular basis and get minutes because he's missed too much football. And I still don't know how he played so well in that World Cup after the injury that he went through, mate. So that just, again, is the credit for the mentality of this guy and the professionalism that he shows.
Well, there's two things. I can't understand how he's not in that Leicester City starting 11.
Yeah.
And then secondly, I can't believe that he's not in it, that he hasn't found another club, that someone else hasn't come in for him and gone, you know what, by the way he played at that World Cup, we've got to snap him up straight away. So that does surprise me.
But I don't think Swartzy, the thing that would be against him is that Leicester signed him and then they got relegated from the Premier League. So there's a few, I know that's nothing to do with him, it's a team thing, but there's that little slant tarnish on him being involved in a relegation team after being in the championship and doing so well. But you've got to see beyond that because he is world class, I think, and he's shown that on several occasions.
Obviously, we're an Australian podcast, and Swartzy, you're the only Australian on the pod today. But if you look at Australia's results,
I've got a passport as well. Thank you very much.
He does,
doesn't he? I completely forgot about that. All right, so I'm here with two typical Australians, and we're just chewing the fat over Australia's game against England. But if you look at their results, your guys' results over over this year, They're really quite good. I mean, up against really like serious opposition, the 3-1 win over Ecuador, lost to Ecuador 2-1, lost to Argentina 2-0, that 2-2 draw with Mexico last month that we spoke about when they played really, really well in the first half particularly. And then this narrow loss to England. So, you know, general, as they say in Spanish, in general lines and sort of general overview, these are a positive group of results. Yeah, not too many wins there, but some really promising performances. My question is this kind of opponents the best kind of preparation for World Cup qualifier or indeed the Asian Cup? Because at the Asian Cup, Australia are going to be the big side. It's Australia's going to have to take the game to much lower ranked opposition. So playing against the likes of Argentina and Mexico and England, is that good preparation for the Asian Cup or not? Or is it just a good way of building the side and developing them to compete on a global level?
Look, I think the way that Australia have played in those games is the most important thing. So And they've gone from game to game and they've continued it. So they haven't, their confidence hasn't been knocked. They've actually, if anything, I think grown in confidence. They went to Wembley. Let's not forget. And I know it is an England changed side, a very changed squad, but Bridgie said correctly so, they are still one hell of a strong side, right? And Australia took the game to them at times. Yeah, they lost 1-0 in the end. I mean, the end result is what matters, but it to a degree, certainly when it comes to tournament football. But I think Australia won't come up against another opposition as good as England, Argentina, or Mexico at the Asian Cup. Japan are good. So Japan and Australia are the ones that are going to be fighting. And I think South Korea, don't write them off as well. There'll always be another one, one of the other nations, whether it's Saudi again or someone else who will cause a surprise. But it is there definitely for Australia and Japan, certainly, and South Korea to a large degree, for their tournament to lose. And I think these games, so long as the momentum continues, so long as the confidence stays, I think they're great preparation. Yes, you want to get wins under your belt, but I think there'll be one or two games between now and then before they play the Asian Cup where they'll be able to get those wins under their belt and then build on it even more.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Swartzy. I think the preparation has been... It's when you look back at the Arnie will be looking back with the coach and have to say, how well did we do? Where can we improve? And there were so many pluses to come from the results, even though it was a loss against England. The draw with Mexico, they can draw on this because what they're also playing against is different cultured football in different continents. So there's different styles in there. And that is absolutely fundamental that you need to understand how you're going to play against other teams. So I think it stands Australia and the Socceroos in great stead going into the Asian Cup. And then the players' names might not be household names around the world like they used to be when Mark was playing. But what Arnie has generated and created is a team that have got this real tough mindset and belief. And they're growing on that from game to game.
And you know what also has impressed me a lot is that at the World Cup, and I was one to say the same thing, I thought it was one of our weakest sides that we sent to the World Cup, but I said it at the World Cup, they actually turn out to be probably our best team that we've ever sent. And they performed unbelievably well. And what surprises me again is that there's no drop-off. So after the World Cup and after that event, you know, one could argue and say, look, it's the biggest tournament in the world. They're on this this wave of emotion and energy and support. And then after the World Cup, they drop off. But the performances haven't. They've actually, if anything, gotten better and stronger. So that's what really impresses me. So it goes on to my next question. The state of the national team, I think, is in a really good place right now. Bridgie, do you agree?
Yeah, I do, mate. And I think Arnie's got to take a lot of credit for that as well, because obviously following what Ange had done with the success of the Asian Cup, doing well in the World Cup, to continue that trend and to take over. And they've got very different styles of football in the past when they were club managers. I know that Arnie's trying to be embraced, and we saw the forward press and against England. But when you've done so well with one previous manager and you get somebody in, and Arnie's obviously had to win the players over and get them to buy into a different mannerism, what he brings to the team, a different style. But he's done it. He's got the cohesion. He's got the belief. And I think they're in a really, really good state at this moment in time, Swartzy. I was very much like you, thinking, oh, it does look very, very weak on paper. But when you see them performing and what the team are doing together as a unit, there's no doubt about it that everybody is pulling in the right direction, which I've played in teams where I've had superstars in their names, as you've done in the past. And it doesn't always guarantee you that you're going to have success, because some of these players just go through the motions. When you get players and managers that have got a belief and that'll go that extra yard, and there's something in there that they've got in the DNA of that culture, he's done very, very well. So I'm very, very... upbeat about how Australia are going to perform going into the Asian Cup and going forward after recent performances.
And that's all in spite of the lack of financial support from state, yes, and federal governments in Australia. If you compare it to the other codes, right? The comments from Ange Postecoglou this week, where he detailed his frustrations about football in Australia never changing and other codes getting more favourable treatment, which was then echoed by Graham Arnold.
Yeah, look, I think Ange has a point when I say that. You know, there was a great legend of Australian football many, many years ago called Johnny Warren, who said, I told you so. You know, nothing's really happened since then either. We have, a sport in Australia, AFL, which is, you know, as Ange said, the Indigenous sport, which is the biggest sport in the country. And there's a lot of funds, a lot of money put into AFL, but it's only played in one country. And we're playing in a world sport, and we don't get anywhere near the resources or the help that that sport does. We see the Prime Minister and the governments, they love coming out to watch, you know, the Matildas and the Socceroos with scarves on, but they must lose them when they go home.
The Prime Minister loves coming to Matildas and Socceroos games with scarves on, but must lose them when they go home. Bridgie, how good a line is that?
Honestly, Arnie is so clever, mate. And the way he is, like, he's worded it perfectly. So it's one thing that I agree on solely. Ange Postecoglou's had a go at it in the past. Obviously, we lost it. We lost an incredible coach. And he was always going to go on to bigger and better things. But we lost him out of our country when he was a pioneer in the industry and what he did. And then he's taken his trade overseas and he's gone and shown it. But it was a big thing. Yes, there's a lot of codes in a lot of sports in Australia, which is, I love that for my family and my kids growing up because they got to play loads of different things. What I couldn't understand is how there is so much money goes to different sports and codes in Australia from the top end, and how football is the global game. And I've seen how much of an effect it has in the world. And yet AFL seems to get the biggest amount of fun when it's played in one country. So for Ange Postecoglou to say it, and then for Arnie to come up and back it up, I just think he's been very, very clever. Now, we've just had a World Cup in Australia in our country, as Swartz is. So that was massive. The momentum that was taken on board and everybody was on top of it. That's when, after the back of the Asian Cup success that we had when Ange won it, they were always saying, oh, now let's get on the bandwagon and let's see where we can take this. And it lasts for about a month. And all of a sudden, all the high-enders in government and all the people in their regions and their states that have got the funding seem to go hiding. So it's a big thing it's a big fundamental flaw in the way that football is received with the funding for the grassroots and all across the board, in my opinion. And I'm delighted that Arnie and Ange are still sticking by the values and the principles to call these people out.
Do you guys think this is going to change? Like, how far away is this from changing? Because he seems pretty exasperated and Ange seems pretty exasperated as well.
Yeah, that's not the first time and it won't be the last time that a manager from the national team will feel that way. I'm just thinking about it and I'm wondering whether or not there is a perception back in Australia, certainly from governmental level, also the other codes, is that their line is, well, football's fine. Those players it's a world game. They go leave Australia, they play all over the world, all those players, and they earn vast numbers of money by being professional footballers abroad, and they also get a large part of their education, further education abroad. So therefore, we don't really need to look after them because in spite of not giving them much money, they're still succeeding. So we don't really need to look after them. And like, you know,
AFL,
it's not
about the top end of the game. It's the grassroots level.
I agree with you. I totally agree with you. I'm just wondering if that's the perception possibly, and maybe that's the line or the argument they go along. I totally agree with you. I'm on board with it, mate. I totally understand. And I believe that it's actually shameful of how little funding we get comparable to the other codes. And I'm not demanding that we get more. I think we should just get our equal share. And I've said this so many times over the last couple of years. I've even tried to go to the FA and offer my services for free to help them with a program to try and somehow reduce the fees in players' registrations, certainly in a more of an elite level. And I've got zero. There was interest and there was a little bit of an excitement, certainly eyebrows being lifted about me actually being offering my services for free and people going, maybe there was a belief that, hang on, this can't be real. But it was genuine. And I'm still to this day, and then we're talking, this is since the World Cup in Qatar, I'm still waiting to this day to hear anything back from the FA. And I've brought it up a couple of times and I still haven't heard anything back from them. So that's what worries me as well, that you want to help and you want to offer your services. The FA don't do justice really, or help themselves in any way, because they leave it and they move on and they do something else. But yeah, it's an ongoing issue.
If there's anything that we can learn in Australia, obviously America football or soccer was obviously a lot lower in their codes of sport as well because of their American sport, the basketball, the NFL. I noticed, I don't know how many years ago it was taking place, but in universities they've got funding for different sports and different codes. And football always used to get the basic amount of money or the minimum amount of money from the universities to be given to their sports. And I think the budgets for the NFL and that were absolutely huge in the basketball because they saw that as a bigger pathway for them. But across the board in the last few years, what they've done is made sure that everything is equal. So the amount of funding that goes into one has to go into the other sport. So it's across the board. The funding has been distributed properly because I think the Americans now have realised that the world game and the football game is absolutely huge. Hence why the MLS has gone on to a whole new level as well with some of the signings that they're still making. So I think Australia and people in the heads of all departments in sport and financial and government can learn a lot from doing that. across the board in Australia to try and make it an equal pathway.
Next question will be, this is a tough one for both of you. I'll be interested to see if you guys have written this down. Strongest Aussie 11 at this point in time.
No. This is for you, Mark.
This is for you, Mark.
No problems. I mean, obviously, for me, I've got Matty Ryan in goal.
Correct.
Obviously, goes without saying. He's the captain. Mm-hmm. I'm inclined, and I know he hasn't started the last two games as it's Bajic. I would have him at right back. Mm-hmm. From what I've seen, I'd still stick with him at right back. And I'm sort of torn a little bit at centre halves. I mean, Cameron Burgess, I thought, did well and has done well for Ipswich this season. I thought he played really well against England. And even though Kai Rowles has done really, really well as well for Australia, I'm feeling a bit torn at the moment. I'm just kind of looking at there's a possibility you could play all three of the big centre halves in Kai Rowles, Burgess and Suter.
And so that's a nice luxury to have. We could change system there, Swartzy. I like what you're thinking here. You could go with three centre halves.
We could. And I think for that reason alone, that's what I'm going to go with my back four, with Kai Rowles, Burgess and Harry Suter in that line. So that's a back four. I've got Craig Goodwin. I agree with you, Bridgie. I liked him the other night. I like every time he plays. I thought he played really well at the World Cup. His delivery into the box is outstanding down that right-hand side. So I'm definitely with him. Jackson Irvine, he's the engine of the team, and I'm going to go with him.
Can I just say one thing, Sporty, on Irvine? I do like him. I like his tenacity. I was watching the game with my wife. Like I say, she only watches Beckham documentaries and the odd game international. She went, how Aussie is he? As soon as he came, she went, how Aussie is he? Like, it was just brilliant.
It's the mustache as well,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think it's the mustache as well. Keanu Backus, I like his energy. I agree. I liked him every time he came on at the World Cup. He's just got this real energy and bounce around him. And I think he's a good footballer as well. And I think he's growing as well in stature.
So would you have him instead of Riley McGree?
I probably would at this stage, yeah. I mean, okay. See, Riley McGree, I think, can play in a number of different positions like he did at the World Cup. So he can also play as that number 10. And I thought he did really well at the World Cup. So that's where I come onto this difficult conundrum in one way. If I was picking a team right now, I'd put Connor Metcalf in that position because I thought he did really well against England right now, right this minute in time, because he's fit.
So far, you've picked the starting 11 that played against England with Behic in for Ryan Strain, I think. So at the moment, it's what we saw at Wembley.
But I think that's where we are right at this minute in time. However, if Aidan Rustich were fit and playing every week, I'd have him in the team every day.
Hmm.
So the problem is he's not been playing, and he doesn't look like he's going to be playing anytime soon at his club. So that's my biggest worry in terms of our sort of creativity, our kind of most technical gifted player. I think Aidan Rustich is the one, and I think we miss him, and we're still performing that well without him. And up front, I don't think there's any other real question mark, and I think Mitchell Duke is really the only one that can play there. And I think he does a good job
of energy, Dukey.
He is.
Is there no place, Mark, for our friend Awa Mabel in the starting 11, or is he just an impact sub?
I think at the moment, again, is that I was just moved. He hasn't been playing regularly. He hasn't played regularly for over 12 months now. Yep. And again, I think that's why I stipulated right in this moment in time, that's the team I'd go with. Yeah. Obviously, 6 months down the line, if we're talking about these guys, or 3 months down the line, Asian Cup, and these guys are all playing football and playing week in, week out, then we'd probably have a different discussion.
I think Arnie would rather use him as an impact player, definitely. I think he can set the Asian Cup alight with his prowess off the bench. Super, super sub.
Martin Boyle obviously is in that team as well. So let's not forget. I actually love seeing him back in the team. I said that before the game. I was last week, I was really looking forward to seeing Martin Boyle because, again, he's another player. He's like, in some ways, he's a bit like Aidan Rustich in terms of gives us something a little bit different. And I just love that he's got a bit of a mongrel in him. He's technically a really good player. I love his energy and I love his commitment. And by all accounts, the boys absolutely love him in the squad as well. So he kind of like, that's why he stayed at the World Cup. Not very often you see players who get injured and are ruled out for a tournament that stay behind and actually still play a big part in the squad. And he did that. So that speaks volumes for him, I'd have to say. Let's move on. Phil. Norway against Spain. Well, first we saw Spain against Scotland, and then we saw Norway against Spain. Spain, they pulled it out of the bag finally, right?
Yeah, they're there. They're at Euro 2024. They've qualified pretty comfortably. I mean, listen, the group was Spain, Scotland, Norway, Georgia, and Cyprus. I think it would have been a national catastrophe had Spain not qualified for Euro 2024. But listen, they were in a slightly difficult situation. Luis de la Fuente takes over from Luis Enrique. There are question marks about the appointment. They lose to Scotland, which is a massive, massive deal here. And as they say in Spain, a jug of cold water poured over your head, because it was really, really a shock. They do not expect to lose these kind of games. And from there, they've gone on a really good run. And against Scotland, I think I've seen this game about 100 times before. Spain having loads of possession, struggling to break down a really well-organized defense, and then just about getting there in the end. They rode their luck a little bit, with Scotland having a brilliant goal from Scott McTominay, ruled out questionably, but it was ruled out. And Spain went on to win. And then against Norway, played really well last night. It was a really, really good performance. They scored one. They could have scored more. Erling Haaland barely touched the ball and really didn't have much of an impact at all. And they were absolutely terrified of Haaland. Genuinely, he is a figure of fear. I mean, they are in awe of him physically, of what he can do, but they marshalled him very, very well. This is a team that has qualified pretty easily, and I would say are maybe just outside the top three in terms of favourites for the Euro. So my top three in terms of favourites, I don't know if you guys agree, France, Portugal, and I'd put England there as well. I think France have the best squad and are probably the best team, but Portugal not far off behind them, and England really should be there. I think those three are really, really considerably better than everyone else. But then Spain are just behind them. I think just behind them, and they're there now, and we'll see what they can do.
Don't rule the Germans out, mate. They're on home soil.
They're in crisis, mate.
They're absolutely horrendous.
Phil, you got the bite you were looking for. You went fishing, Phil. Well done. And he had his bite.
I have ruled the Germans out, to be fair. Yeah. I'm sorry. But yeah.
Yeah, don't worry. You're not the only one. I ruled them out about 6 months ago.
Never ruled them out.
No, definitely. Yeah, look, it all changed. We all know it's like, Bridgie, right? A new manager comes in, the whole thing can change immediately. And there's no doubting they've got a talented squad. It's just finding the right combination and getting in playing decent football. They haven't been able to do that yet. Let's see if Julian Nagelsmann is the man to do it. Let's go back to Norway. I've got to talk about Norway, because we talk about them continuously being one of the biggest underachievers. In the past, Wales is a great example. You've got Gareth Bale, Aaron Ramsey. They're the two players that practically sort of like, they were the gel in that team. They took them through to European Championships, to a World Cup. I mean, what is it with Norway? What is going wrong with them? They've got arguably two of the best players in the world right now in Ødegaard and Haaland. And you mentioned there, Phil, Haaland didn't get a touch, hardly got a touch on the ball. What is it about this Norway side at the moment, certainly with those two top class players, not being able to put it together and string results together and qualify for big tournaments? Bridgie?
I think Phil was saying there that Haaland didn't get a touch of the ball against Norway. He doesn't tend to get many touches of the ball for Man City neither. But when he does, they're in the back of the net. And playing Spain, you know, the possession stats were horrendous for Norway, to be fair. And I think a lot of teams find that when you do play Spain, the amount of possession they have, they just suffocate the ball. But like Phil says, they don't tend to get many shots on target at either end, do Spain. So it's a possession in a certain area of the field where you're thinking, can we do something in the final third? However, Norway really struggled to get the ball back off them. They didn't, and when they did, they squandered the chances. They were just trying to look for that early pass in behind for Haaland. It became one-dimensional. So when I see Odegaard and Haaland, and you talk about that Bale and Ramsey team that carried the finals, I still think they had a lot more players than Norway have got playing at the highest end of the professional spectrum in Europe, if not in the Premier League. Now, no disrespect to some of the other players around for the Norwegian team, because you know we've got the centre half playing for Napoli is absolutely brilliant. I can't even pronounce his name.
Ødegaard.
Thank you. Yes. You know, they've got players, they've got the capability, but they just seem, they rely too much on these two and the pressure that they must be feeling. Every time you look if Norway scored, in the past you've seen, oh yeah, Haaland. They don't seem to share the joy. The Welsh team, I felt, carried the pressure as a whole. It was all about Bale and Ramsey, but it was never there. They weren't the main emphasis. So this Norwegian team have got a lot of, if they want to achieve stuff, they've got a lot. Everybody's got a chip in as well, mate. And I don't know how they do about this. What's your take on it, Swartzy?
I'm just wondering, like Norway's sort of a team that generally over history, I think, predominantly has always stuck with Norwegian managers. Maybe they need to look abroad. Maybe they need to look someone else to come in and take control of these kind of like big stars. Maybe that's an avenue they need to look at and try and get the best out of them.
Do you mean it certainly isn't working the way they're doing. Like team shape, or do you mean from an egotistical point of view to keep everybody together?
I think possibly more so about from a respect and egotistical level. We had it in 2001, 2002 2005 when they brought Gus Hiddink in. That was a big, big change for us, bringing a manager such huge respect and such a massive reputation, and a manager that nobody expected Australia to be able to attract. And the minute he walked in that door, he had instant respect from every single player, and every player were prepared to run through a brick wall for him, you know. And I think that is something that, I mean, we're not talking of a goose hitting nature possibly for Norway, but why not? Why wouldn't they aim for someone really big, someone with a lot of respect, and someone that the players would react to the minute he walked in through that door? And I think that's possibly something I'd be looking at if I were Norway.
I was watching the game yesterday, and the cameras focused on the Norway manager, who is Ståle Solbakken. And I did a double take because he looked a lot like Erik ten Hag, Maybe he had a little beard. I mean, I think there's a bit of age difference, but maybe ten Hag won't thank me saying it. But it looked like ten Hag. I was like, hold on a second, what have I? No. It's Ståle Solbakken. But yeah, I mean, just going on with what you're saying about bringing in a foreign manager. Maybe that's the when things don't go too well for ten Hag at Manchester United. Maybe that's the next stop.
So you look at Scotland that are doing so well. And I spoke to John Carver. He's from Newcastle, my region. I spoke to him. He's loving his assistant role with Clark. And what he was saying, he said, Bridget, we don't have superstars like the Spanish have got. We don't have individual superstars like what Norway have got. And he mentioned the two boys we talked about in Haaland Odegaard. He said, yes, we've got some great players, but what we have got, the team dynamics are absolutely incredible. And the players, it's a bit like what we're talking about with Australia and the Socceroos. There's no standouts that are global world names. I know I'm not underestimating Scotland because McTominay and everybody, they are up there. But what we're talking about is individual world-class elite players that Scotland, they've got a team dynamics, and they are doing so much better because they've all bought into what Clark and John Carver have brought to Scotland. And I wouldn't have thought that McTominay would have been one of the top goal scorers in the Euro qualifiers. Do you know what I mean? But he just seems to be their go-to man. But they've got a team. So Norway, I like what you've said, Swartzy. I think you're right. They've got to find some way that everybody buys into what they're doing and not rely on these two players.
Now that you mentioned Scotland, we're going to big up them because they've qualified with two games to spare in a group that we're talking about, Norway, and how underperformed they have with the players that they have in their squad. On paper, it should be Spain-Norway, right? But that's not how it works. We all know that. And Spain kind of stumbled up until these last couple of games. Now they're sitting pretty and they're fine. They've qualified, job done. Scotland, got to give them Steve Clarke, massive amount of respect and congratulations on what they've accomplished so far. Beating Spain, Phil, like you said, that was huge, right?
How did that go down over there?
What, beating Spain? Terribly. Yeah. Like I said, it was genuinely, they were shocked. They were absolutely shocked. I mean, I think it was the second game in charge for the new manager. He changed things up a bit. It was a Spain side, if not in transition, but certainly undergoing some changes. So that was maybe cited as a bit of an explanation. But I mean, Scotland were worthy winners in that game. And actually, against Spain on Friday night, they played pretty well. I was genuinely impressed with how organized they were, how little they conceded to Spain. They looked I'm not going to say overly dangerous, but, you know, they had some situations where they caused Spain some problems. They've got the same number of points as Spain in this group. The same number of points. They've conceded the same number of goals as Spain. They've both conceded 3 goals in 6 matches, which is extremely impressive. All right, Spain have scored 19, Scotland have scored 12, but that's still 2 goals a game on average for a Scotland side that traditionally hasn't been a side that has been associated with free-flowing football and scoring lots of goals. So the change in this Scotland team has been enormous. The credit that has to go to Steve Clarke is enormous. And they'll go there now, qualifying for a major tournament. They will bring an unbelievably large amount of fans. They will bring colour and vibrancy to the tournament. And I'm not going to say they're a dark horse. I'm not going to do a ridiculous Bridgie prediction, but I'm saying that they're a team that will be able to go toe-to-toe and cause problems for some of the bigger nations, as we've seen in this qualifying campaign.
Well, I'm delighted that they are there, because if England qualify against them at some stage, whether it's the groups or into the quarters, the semis, it's an easy win, so we'll progress. So the Tartan Army can come in all their numbers, but unfortunately the Three Lions will progress further.
The interesting link stat that you just mentioned there was 12 goals that Scotland have scored, and McTominay has scored 10 of those. So we talk about Norway over a reliance on one player. It's seemingly at this qualifiers, Scotland have relied heavily on McTominay, right? But obviously a very different player, and he's produced every single game. So big up to him for doing it. Not getting a lot of game time with Man United either, being ridiculed to a large degree, playing, you know, a lot of people wanted him out. He was supposed to be leaving, but turned it around. The other player I want to quickly talk about is Cristiano Ronaldo, Portugal. He's in Saudi, a lesser league, of course. Let's not beat around the bush, nowhere near it. He scored 2 goals against Slovakia. Yes, Slovakia, but still, he's scoring goals still, right, Phil? He's still a big player for Portugal. Still a fantastic goal scorer.
He is absolutely obsessed. Absolutely obsessed with scoring goals and maintaining himself amongst the world's elite. Why did he go to Saudi Arabia then? Well, he's gone there and he's still doing it for his international country. I think it's interesting, actually, because if we make the comparison, for example, with Jordan Henderson, who has also gone to Saudi Arabia and maybe looked a little bit off the pace in the middle of the park for England. Okay, playing in midfield maybe requires a bit more intensity than being a striker. I'm not sure, but there were people suggesting that, oh, he's gone to Saudi and the intensity is so much less there in the league that he can't compete on an international scale. Well, Ronaldo is obviously the shining example of that is simply not the case. Having said that, Ronaldo is such a freak in the nicest sense of the word, such a against all odds, against all nature, it shouldn't happen. He shouldn't be scoring this amount of goals at international level, and he's still doing it. And he's going to his 6th European Championship. I mean, that is just absolutely ludicrous. And I think, is he only 38 going on 39, I think, something like that. So I'm not saying he's going to play in a 7th, but he will feel that he can, and he will be obsessed with doing it that he can. So just this relentless focus is just incomparable, I think, to anyone else.
Didn't he just come out, Phil, and say recently that he's looking at the 1,000 goal tally for the
entire Yeah. That's what I'm saying. He's obsessed, completely obsessed with scoring goals.
I was happy with 1,000 minutes, let alone 1,000 goals. I was just happy to get 1,000 minutes under my belt.
I don't have the stats to hand, but I think it's around 850 goals he scored, something like that. So, you know, he's not far off, and you wouldn't back against him getting 1,000 goals at all.
The question I want to ask, and it's very controversial, are Portugal better with him in the team or better without him in the team? Is he kind of almost holding them back a little bit because of the way he plays and the game has to focus around him, or does he actually help them, Bridgie?
Who was the player that scored the hat trick in the World Cup when he came on and he started instead of Ronaldo?
It was Gonzalo Ramos.
Yeah, thank you. Gonzalo Ramos, there we go. Yeah, you talk about Ronaldo. Can he make a team better? Yes, he can. I think any team Ronaldo plays in is going to be better because he the world class he is. I understand the argument suggesting that when he does, he holds other players back. So somebody that's thriving off that, when you think the World Cup, the hat-trick that Ramos did score in Ronaldo's absence, it only fuels fire for Ronaldo then to go, oh, hang on a minute, here we go. I've got to up my game again. So it's healthy competition. And like you say, we've talked about him wanting to get to 1,000 goals, which I think is absolutely crazy that he's got that mindset. He's up for any challenge. So he'll mentor them brilliantly because of the player that he is and the guy that he is. but then he's up for the challenge. So I don't think whether he, I think Portugal are lesser if he is not in their squad, Swartzy, put it that way. If he's not in the squad, they become, I think they become disorganised and they've lost a monumental player. When he plays, he's different class.
I think it's a very valid question that Schwartz is posing, and it's one that I think has been posed a lot in Portugal over the last year or so, and there's been a sort of existential crisis. You know, can we have one of the best players of all time, but is he the player to play in this side? I think it's important to note that now Portugal have a different manager. Fernando Santos was in charge at the World Cup, who was perhaps a little bit more defensive, someone who played with a little bit more on the handbrake, and now Roberto Martinez has come in and is someone who wants to play a bit more football and utilize the extraordinarily talented ball-playing players that he has at his disposal. And we'll see whether or not Ronaldo fits into that system. Ronaldo and Ramos both started against Slovakia. So maybe there's a way that they can both start and be effective for Portugal. I think if you look at their squad and you look at their starting 11, it's borderline ridiculous how good it is. And they've got to be, along with France and England, major favourites for this tournament, because in terms of talent, and now with a manager that wants to harness that talent, I think they're a really extraordinary team.
Who am I to ask that question? Sorry?
Did Ronaldo score against you, Swartzy? Because we've talked about Beckham putting one past you. How many did Ronaldo score against
you? Probably. You know what? I actually can't remember. The one thing that stands out for me was the ridiculous penalty that he got against me at the Riverside. It was the biggest dive you'll ever see in your life. And I was about a foot away from him when he dived. And the referee, from his angle, gave it. And this is a true story. I've said this story before, I'm pretty sure, on a podcast or somewhere along the line, whereby the referee was adamant, and I said to him, mate, you've made a massive cock up. Wait until you watch on TV. Anyway, I saw him about 3 or 4 weeks later, and he came up to me and went, I have to apologize. My wife gave me an absolute bollocking when I got home, because she said, how the hell can you give that as a penalty? Like, he was so far away from the goalkeeper that he dived. So, yeah, so that was the one moment that always just sticks in my head about Cristiano Ronaldo. Look, there's no debating. He's an absolute phenomenon. And his goal-scoring record is insane. He's over 200 international caps. Who am I to even ask that question? But I just find it intriguing, because he's still scoring goals. And so how do you argue? He's 37, 38 years old. How do you – and I was in that position as well, whereby people start to write you off at the latter stages of your career, right? So he's doing everything. He's doing everything right. He's contributing. He's scoring goals. He's still fit. But it's still a good question to ask, right? Because it opens up a debate.
Totally, totally. And like I said, this has been the question that has been going on in Portugal for a long time. And I've got a Portuguese friend in Lisbon who about 6 or 7 months ago was saying, no, Cristiano can't start and Cristiano's finished and this manager and why is he playing him? And at the World Cup, he was absolutely slating Cristiano. And I have to check in on him this morning and see how he's doing and see whether or not he's still feeling the same way, because Cristiano likes to shut people up with his goals, and maybe he's done that to some of the detractors.
Absolutely. I think he has. And he'll do it for some time still into the future. There's no doubt about that whatsoever. Anyway, now it's time to chat WSL from the weekend. Joining us is Narelle Sindos and Michelle Escobar.
Thanks, Schwartzy. Well, another exciting week in the Women's Super League indeed, Michelle, but Arsenal, they left it very, very late to come back from Aston Villa.
Yeah, and they're lucky that they had 12 minutes of added time, and that's when they scored their two goals, with Katie McCabe finding the back of the net in the 92nd minute, and then Alessia Russo a couple of minutes later. But yeah, it was so dramatic in the end. It would have been amazing to be there because of the atmosphere, but it does pose the question, can they afford to keep on doing this?
I know. You'd have to say probably not, because we saw last season there is little room for error. You don't want to drop many more points at the stage in the competition as well. But you touched on the added time. I feel like that only really became a thing since Qatar. We saw those crazy amounts of minutes added on. And Aston Villa weren't happy. But that added time had to be made up from somewhere, right? You don't just pull 12 minutes out of thin air.
Yes, but it does feel like now they're counting almost every single second where something happens, where a player goes down, and we are seeing a lot. And I mean, it's understandable that Carla Ward, the Aston Villa coach, was furious about it, because that's what changed the game from Aston Villa essentially getting 3 points to none. So you can see why she was fuming.
Flip side, though, they only scored in the 92nd and 94th minute. I think it'd be different if it was like, you know, 102 minutes or whatever it works out to be. But it was also really good to see Alessia Russo on the score sheet, her first goal in Arsenal colours. And I feel like they will only do wonders to her confidence. And perhaps this is the turning point for her.
Yeah, definitely. And there were questions around whether there's going to be a blossoming partnership between Beth Mead, who's come back from an ACL injury that kept her out for 11 months, and Alessia Russo. I mean, Jonas Eideval said that, you know, he's hoping that something can come of it. And it'd be great to see. I mean, they play together for England, so we have seen them, you know, do wonders for the Lionesses. So maybe they can bring that to Arsenal. That's what at least everyone would be hoping for.
Yeah, because it can sometimes go the other way when you've got too much star power and too many individual, like, brilliant talents, that they don't really gel or it takes them longer than usual.
Well, that seems to be the case this season so far, right? That Arsenal aren't living up to expectations. I mean, we all got asked who we thought was going to be winning the league this season, and a lot of us thought Arsenal.
Not because, just because the Aussies, right?
No, just because of the Aussies, but because of the new signings and also the star power that they have. But we do have to remember as well that some of their best players, like Meade Maher and Leah Williamson, are still injured. So, I mean, maybe they just need a little bit more time, but then again, how much time can they take when it's not going to affect their results?
Absolutely, yeah. Schwartzy, you just wonder, will the slow start to the season eventually come back to bite them?
You know what? Normally I'd say yes. For Arsenal to have a slow start, only picking up 4 points from their first three games in a 22-game season, let's not forget, there's not a lot of games. However, they got no Champions League football this year, which is their own doing, being knocked out in the qualifying stages. That could actually work in their favour. But Jonas Eideval needs to get things right because he's made so many changes to his starting lineup each week so far. He's changed the goalkeepers already twice. So I think that's the only concerning thing. However, I also believe that the league will be a lot closer this season. Chelsea have won, but they've just won games. And I think there are a lot of clubs now that will be contesting. I don't think there'll be one standout. I don't think Chelsea will run away with it this season. And I think Arsenal still have a bit of time left to get points on the board. And interesting, that takes me on to Bridgie. You know, we've seen it in the past with, you know, in the Premier League, of course, where teams struggle to begin with. Certainly in Man City, maybe slow starts, but they've gone on and won the league and quite comfortably in the end. It's all about momentum, right? Once you get wins under your belt, you start to motor along, right?
Yeah, well, I go back to the 99 season, 2000, when Leeds United, we were top of the league at Christmas Water. We thought we'd won the league and we ended up finishing third. And Man United got momentum, Arsenal got momentum towards the back end and they came through. And it was probably the biggest tarnish that I remember because we thought we'd won it. So I'm all for this. Any league that I see, whether it's whatever sport it is, I don't care. As long as I see Tottenham above Arsenal, I'm always happy. And Tottenham are above Arsenal in the Premier League, Tottenham are above Arsenal in the WSL. And I just feel this season, both competitions, the Premier League and the WSL, what I'm absolutely thriving on is the fact that there's so many teams are going to be involved in the mix to be title contenders this season. And I'm absolutely delighted as well also to see Liverpool, who in the WSL recently got promoted from the Championship. They always seem to struggle when they come at the WSL. The funding's gone in there. Liverpool are having a right good go in this as well. So they're up to fifth ahead of Manchester United. So I am really looking forward to seeing what happens. And like you say, if anybody's going to chase down Chelsea this season, the WSL is going to be huge. And the Premier League chasing down Man City, it's open. So bring on both leagues. I'm going to be watching with intrigue.
Bridgie, you said Tottenham are above Arsenal in the Premier League.
Tottenham are above everyone in the Premier League, Bridgie.
Yes!
Everyone.
There we go, Phil. I'll just tee you up, mate.
There we go. Nice.
Absolutely
one.
Brilliant. Yeah, and you mentioned Spurs and WSL as well. They actually look pretty good. They did well against Chelsea the other week. They should have beaten Chelsea or got a result out of the game at Stamford Bridge. They did very, very well. And also have to mention...
Sorry to interrupt again there, mate. I've got to say, though, I hope we're going to give, me and Phil are, we're cheerleaders for Tottenham. We've got to give Ange Postecoglou a shout out, mate. He's just gone back to back for manager of the months. It's never been done before, mate. Honestly, that is ridiculous.
Yeah, no, absolutely superb from Ange. And look, he keeps proving the doubters wrong and keeps doing his thing. And let's hope that continues for some time into the future. Anyway, that's all we've got time for this week, guys. I'd like to thank you again for joining us this week, Phil.
Thanks, mate. See you next week.
Thank you very much, Bridgie, as well. As always, even though I didn't mention Leeds United are only fifth in the championship, Leicester are top 30 points. Leeds United are only on 19, probably won't get promoted. But anyway, I'm not going to give you any chance to get back into that one. So anyway, reminder, every game in the Premier League and La Liga is live only on Optus Sport. We have European qualifiers this week and the WSL continues across the weekend too. Thanks for your company on the Optus Sport Football Podcast. See you next time.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.